Okay, so welcome to Tech Ed Day, what is it, 3 for you guys? Having fun so far? Cool? Great. I'm not going to do the Brad Anderson to you guys where I said I want some more energy in the room, so we will see what we can do. My name is Uli Hohmann. I'm a partner-level architect in the cloud and enterprise business. Last year, if you saw me, I was still in the consulting business. Now I've moved over to engineering and am hoping to give you some ideas of what's going on with this Azure stuff from an architecture perspective. And how does this really affect you? Some of this you have already seen, because when you look at some of the innovations that came out in Windows Server 2012 and R2, like the software-defined networking stuff, while there are a lot of pieces that were driven by the Windows Server team itself, a lot of this came from the big data center work that drove out of Azure. There is some stuff that flows back from Windows Server into Azure because they have been at enterprise scale and capability since a while, but most of it flows from the big data centers out into the Wild West that you have to manage. And I want to give you a pretty big tour around all of these concepts that range from data center design to this mysterious fabric thing that everybody talks about. How many of you have used the word fabric in either presentations or written articles without really defining it? Because I can't find a definition for it. Because everybody has lots of fabrics. I reviewed one document where the word fabric came, I think, 50 times in one page. And I said, no, we got to change this. And so I'm going to give you some ideas of what we think of as a fabric and what the ideas are. And then I'm switching a bit from the infrastructure side to the software development side. Because this is about architecture, and so this is a very big element of what's happening. If you were summarizing the architecture patterns that are really changing, we are pushing more responsibility from the infrastructure to the software people, the people that write software development tools or that write solutions. And that is a big shift, and some of this that we have to balance, because so far, infrastructure has propped up a lot of applications that just are not behaving well. But now you have to find a balance in your new world of how does the application really support you and what does the infrastructure do? Because there's a couple of fundamental shifts. The one thing that we see is that people don't really appreciate the scale of what Google, Microsoft, and Amazon are driving. Scott Guthrie, my boss, keeps telling people, saying, look, there's a million server club. The million server plus club are these three. The rest is not even close. And when you are at that scale, things change pretty dramatically. So with that, let's go and see what changes. So some of you have might seen this slide before because our GFS, the Global Foundation Services people that run our data centers, the network infrastructure and so forth, have used this since a while, but it is still an interesting concept. Because when we designed Chicago, which was designed in 2007 and opened in 2009, we actually designed it with fairly old principles in mind. It was a billion-dollar expense, or actually a little bit more. And any of you that have built data centers before, that is a normal number for a 5-9 data center that you would have to design. The upper floor is a traditional IT floor with raised floors, hot and cool aisles, and all this other good stuff. And the lower floor is actually the container halls, where we effectively, only for Bing at the time, actually were hosting containers, wiring 2,000 machines at a pop. So you effectively don't get a rack of machines or 5 or 10 servers. You get an entire container with 2,000 machines. When you do that, there's a couple of things that happen. One is you can't really go and have somebody in sneakers go around and turn the machines on and make sure that the right stuff is burned in and so forth. So what you're doing is you effectively turn the container on and all the machines flip on and you burn in stuff. You can only do that if you drive automation like crazy. So most of you will have done automation, but the question is how far do you scale the automation? Does it really go down to the network configuration, the bare metal configuration, and how far do you go? Do you have built-in burn-in tests? So we have a couple of tests that run for a couple of days before we actually admission the hardware into production, because we know that the booting up of the thing will actually most likely impact, or if the failure happens, it happens actually often at the first turn-in time, and so forth. The interesting thing is that we are actually going back from the data center in the container to a less containerized design. It's an interesting one that I will talk about next year, but not this year. It's just going to be some learnings that we had that the container as a structure is actually not very flexible. We are moving back to a non-containerized deployment, still in bulk, but not in an enclosure called a container anymore. So the other piece that I want to, the reason why I'm sharing this with you is this is going to go back and forth, left and right a bit. And so the world is learning a bunch of things around operating at that scale. If you run a million plus servers, I think the official number is 1.2 million servers that we operate across Office 365, Bing, and Azure, and a bunch of other little things, but those are the three big ones. We learn a bunch of things that we eventually share with you in guidance, but also in software. So Windows Server is the effectively packaging of a lot of those learnings that we have at that level. If you think about your enterprise architecture, and of course your mileage will vary, you will see that most of the time we're talking about silos that are the data center people, the compute network and storage people, and all of them separate, and then you have the application people. I've talked to customers around the globe. That's one of my jobs. If you ever wanted to do diamond level flying, come talk to me and apply for my job. That will actually do it because I fly, I think, 250,000 miles a year or something like that. So I see customers across the globe. And when I talk about this slide is effectively I have to meet with at least five people or five teams. I have to talk to the data center guys that are building a 5-9 data center infrastructure. Then I'm talking to the network people, and there are two network people. There are the Cisco kind of guys, and then there are the rack people that I have to think about. And then I talk to the compute and the storage people, and they're all different. And then I might talk to an application team, and they will be lucky if they ever talk to each other. So one of the key things that we have done a while back, because we had the same thing with the data center guys, the network compute and storage people, we now call all of that Azure. The only thing that we don't call Azure is how do you build the data center in terms of real estate and the egress ingress. That's about it. The rest is all Azure. So it's one team, and the technical leadership, most of you will know Mr. Rosinovich, Mark, who is also here, and he's talking later today. And effectively, he's leading from a conceptual technical vision perspective that convergence between network, storage, and compute. That is one team. If I were you and you are in charge of certain organizational aspects of your organization, that is one of the recommendations I would make, is make the network, compute, and storage team work as one rather than as three teams. Because the efficiencies you get, even if you don't switch to a converged infrastructure, which some of you might on the path to do, some of them cannot or don't want to yet, it still makes a lot of sense to really think of this as a consistent set of resources and architectures that you want to manage as one, organizationally as well as technically. Why organizationally? I don't know about you guys. For some reason at Microsoft, if we get reorged into one team, we all of a sudden start working together. Doing this across boundaries is a very hard thing to do. Again, Microsoft is a very good example there. The other piece I want you to really pay attention to is this little yellow circle. The network is becoming one of those key things that always has been important, but is becoming more important because of the distributed nature of the entire fabric and the entire approach. Microsoft has done a lot of work on what's called a Quantum 10 network. If you have seen some of the older TechEd presentations from Youssef Khalidi, who is the network dude, quote unquote, at Microsoft. And he has been working on how do we effectively make traffic go north and south, which is really the inbound outbound from the data center perspective, and then east and west, which is between the various racks in a data center. And we have effectively created a mesh network instead of a tree network inside the east and west boundaries because of the service-oriented nature of the applications we have. When I talk about Azure, I always talk about the people that read books. How many of you have read the SOA books? There's a very famous author that wrote these big books, and I think 10 of them, about SOA. And I think one of the Azure guys got one of the books, which is called Service-Oriented Infrastructure. And he read it, and he said, or she, and said, wow, this is really cool. Let's build Azure around this, because that's effectively what they have done. They're using the network as a separation between what the physical infrastructure looks like and what the software is that runs on top of it. So when you design a service in Azure, that is effectively isolated as a network boundary. So if you look at SQL Azure, for example, some of you have used it in your normal applications, right? And you were surprised that the application didn't work. Why? Because the latency between the compute node where your code runs and the service that's called SQL Azure was guaranteed 3 times higher than what you normally have. Why? Because it's a service, not a server. And a service is guaranteed to be on the other side of a router. And so you have at least 2 network hops to go from your network code that runs application logic to that service. And that was one of the number one things that failed on customers, where they say, wait a second, I'm using SQL Server, and SQL Azure is like SQL Server, right? Yes, but it's a service, not a server. And so when you think about the network, it's a very powerful concept that you can effectively take this distribution and tear it apart. Because I'm sure a lot of you have to think about, how do I provide the SQL services in a way that the applications continue to work? Any of you application designers writing SQL code? You're all trained to use SQL as if it were a cache, because it's right next to you from a network perspective. And that has to change, because we are going to see more stretching, more latency coming into the data center. And that's why this network thing is so important, and that's why we're pushing so much emphasis on how do you really design apps that understand latency because of these changes. And of course, because of the global distribution of the beast. If anybody talks to me about cloud, most people will immediately go into data centers and computers and storage and network in the data center. I actually look at cloud as, yes, there's a bunch of data centers, but there's even more important, a bunch of network. Microsoft, Google are among the largest network operators in the world by now, because we run global clouds. Google at this point primarily for YouTube. We primarily for Office 365, Bing, and Azure. But at the end of the day, it is about the convergence of wide area networking or global networking with effectively the compute power and optimization of where you put stuff, resources, in order to optimize the user behavior. And part of this consideration is something, how do you do that? Is your global data center network that you might have capable of really running with these new patterns and new application scenarios? Or are you thinking, I'm actually going to take my network architecture or my data center architecture and look at my data center plus Microsoft's data centers as one. So if you keep on one message that certainly we have been pushing, this time at TechEd, hybrid clouds. The way I look at modern data center is the one I don't have to build, first of all, because I use somebody else's data center. And I extend the capabilities that I have on-premise already into something that is capable of reaching everywhere. Most of you will have heard that we have just added Japan, we just added Brazil, we added China, we're adding a whole bunch of other capabilities. So if you didn't have IT capabilities in China, very expensive to build, and the Chinese have some very peculiar laws that you have to also understand. We already have had our lawyers go through all that stuff, so it might be easier to just use our environment. A couple more things to think about. When you look at the enterprise IT, and again, this is a typical IT customer. If you are different, don't feel offended. But it's kind of a picture of how we look at things. From a server perspective, we're moving from tens of thousands. One big customer in the banking system that I know has 60,000 Windows servers, but that's a very, very, very big banking customer, and that's only Windows. So they're about 100,000, 120,000 servers. That's a very big customer. But most customers I've seen are in below 10,000 servers, and they're trying to get to lower physical servers using virtualization and so forth. But cloud scale means we are designing our data centers to run at million plus scale. I think the Titanfall numbers, have they been released at TechEd? I know that Scott talked about them at Build. So this little game that we just released together with our partners on Xbox One used 100,000 virtual machines, just like that. And really, underneath the covers, they used 500,000 cores. So that's effectively the capacity what we were able to provide to them for just that thing. In order to do that, you have to change a number of things. One of the things that we are seeing, and that will actually come to you fairly soon, is that hardware will actually go down in price. When you think about these numbers, it's all about unit costs. If you have a very small number of units, it's not a big deal. If you have 100 servers, 500 servers, yes, it will make a difference. But if you have 1,000 servers or a million servers, that makes a big difference. So one of the engineering changes that our people have to go through is they are now talking about COGS, about costs of goods that they are effectively bringing into the equation. Microsoft never, ever talked about COGS inside the engineering teams. You had to deal with that in terms of how do I deploy Windows Server or SharePoint or any of this other stuff. But now our people are thinking about how do I engineer my architecture, my systems, so that they are effectively cost efficient, hardware cost efficient. Because the software cost is almost nil if you think about the scale effect. And that's why we're pushing everything into software. And so the software load balancer architecture in Azure, for example, we did this for a number of reasons, but one of them was cost. Despite having a great partnership with F5 as our load balancer partner, these thingies, especially at scale, cost a lot of money. And so we took them out for effectively cost reasons and control reasons. But when you scale to that level, you have to start thinking about these kind of things. And that's one of the reasons why software-defined data centers will include, over time, software-based load balancers. So a lot of the stuff that we discarded a while back, like software-designed sharding and mirroring and so forth, is back as a vengeance or in a vengeance because of these scale effects. And that has some changes in terms of how we think about things. So MTBF to MTTR, everybody clear what that means? So we used to count the days between failures of hardware and try to extend the time between the failure and effectively what we could do about it. So we try to avoid failures, really the big way of thinking about it. When you think about the new world, we're effectively saying with these many moving parts, we have to assume that everything fails at any point in time. So we cannot protect ourselves by doing some crazy stuff and saying we buy better hardware because they claim that their failure time from zero to whatever failure is takes longer. It doesn't really help us because when you look at statistics, something will always fail. And so MTTR is effectively the two things. One, we don't really count on failures to be avoidable, but we also don't assume that, or we are putting emphasis on discovering failure and dealing with it rather than avoiding failure. If you think about cluster-based design, the failover cluster stuff, failover clusters were designed to protect single resources and effectively make failures make the failure window last longer in terms of avoiding failure. When you look at the cluster design in the cloud, we assume that any of these ring resources that we're using for SQL Azure, for the VMs, or any of this stuff, will die at any point in time, and we have to be able to reestablish healthy systems. So we recreate rather than trying to create a single image of stuff. So we have multiple copies and so forth. The other piece that's interesting is that the hardware availability, in this case here, network, is 5 nines in a normal enterprise. I've seen that as a normal thing. And we assume only 3 nines. I've seen a lot of customers go into the cloud with these bushy-tailed, very optimistic cloud ideas, where clouds don't fail. We'll talk about that clouds fail quite a lot, actually, because they are designed to fail. So your software has to make up the slack. There can be 99.99, so 5.9 availability on cloud software, but it's not going to be based upon the availability of the hardware or software of the cloud. It's your software that has to make up the slack. And you make decisions based upon a number of criteria of how to make that work. Again, I can tell you name brand ABC that went into the cloud, didn't put any protection into their software because clouds don't fail, and all of a sudden they were down for 5-6 hours because we had an outage, or the other cloud providers have outages. So it's not something that you can avoid. Because we embrace failure, you have to embrace failure and say, what do I do about it? And stuff like that. So think about these things when you go into clouds, also into your clouds at home. Because these things will effectively happen eventually to you because cheap hardware, commodity hardware, will become part of your data center if you are more of an expensive hardware person right now. The other piece that we are pushing very hard on is a switch from allocating by space to allocating by power. I was part of a project in the UK where we actually had a spreadsheet with all the nominal power inputs, outputs that the components used. And we were so close to the margin in this UK data center that effectively every time we wanted a new server, we put it into the spreadsheet, say, sorry, nope, we're out of power, we can't do this anymore. That was in the day before heavy virtualization, but it's still true. And so when you look at where we place our data centers, we place our data center where there's lots of space, because we don't care about space, and where there's cheap power. So, and again, all of the big data center providers do the same thing. The latest rage is either Iceland, that's where everybody goes right now, or actually Scandinavia in the very, very north of Scandinavia. Because the network is good enough from a latency perspective, and it's cold enough so that we can effectively do air-based air cooling and so forth. So we don't go near big centers normally. The exception is Europe, where we are in Amsterdam and in Dublin, which is fairly centralized, but you see the rest. Boyden in Virginia is somewhere in the boonies. Sorry if you're from Virginia, no offense. But the rest is really in the boonies. Quincy, Washington, there are 3 people, 5 cows, and lots of data centers, effectively, because Google is there, we are there, Dell is there, a bunch of people, because of the hydraulic power that is right next door. So when you think about new data centers, don't think about space, think about power, and think about how do you get power in a continuous fashion that's cheap. Because power costs will rise over the next couple of years for sure. These internal tools, we're still debating how we make them available or if we make them available. They are just ways for us to track a number of things. One thing that I want you to pay attention to is tracking carbon. This green stuff, which was before the financial crash very hot, if you were around, before 2008, everybody talked about green IT and blah, blah, blah. That went down when the financial system melted down, and so everybody was worried about other things. We're back to worrying about green. And so the EU, the US, and lots of other people have actually put carbon-based accounting into play. So if you are in the data center business or into server business, you have to start accounting for carbon. And that is something that you will have to start thinking about. How do you track that? How do you report back? Because it's going to be part of your annual report of how carbon efficient you are. I know that the UK is very aggressive, Germany is very aggressive, so that's something to think about, which we have already built into our data centers. So you will get a report from us for your reporting, but something you need to think about when you move into the cloud. So this is an Office 365 slide, just something that I wanted to share with you in terms of when you think about the big move that we are thinking about, when you look at clouds. And I'm not distinguishing between public clouds, private clouds, hybrid clouds, FUBAR clouds. What I'm looking at is an architecture pattern. When you really think about what's happening with clouds, the number one thing that happens, we're moving from software delivery to service delivery. Some of you have that in your blood. If you're a mainframe person, that has been there forever because you're doing a service, and an online service, and there might be other aspects. But as a Windows person or a PC person, a service mentality is not something that you have been thinking about a lot. And so for the Windows guys, let's call it there, but also the Linux guys, service orientation, not in the sense of software design, but in the sense of operational design, is certainly something to think about. So look at standardization. I've talked to many, many, many customers that effectively have established a zoo of every technology that's out there. Any vendor, any technology, they have it, if they're of a certain size. Microsoft was no different, except that we only used Windows. But we still had the business application people drive the software artifacts that they wanted. And that won't change forever or anytime soon, but you still have to start to say, okay, what is the architecture that you want to drive? The Office 365 guys are working towards a single architecture. They have the luxury of being in control of the software side and the data center side, so they're working on a single architecture. The word I would use is few architectures. As few architectures as you can get away with. And really try to establish not necessarily standards in technology. That's one side of the equation. I know that a lot of people do that with IT governance boards and saying, you shall use Oracle, SQL Server, whatever. And then there's a new app that somebody wants and that brings in MySQL, and all of a sudden, all of those governance thingies are not that important anymore. So you might want to go away from demanding specific technology and more talk about what's the operational framework you're interested in, what is it that you're looking for in terms of making your life easier, because patching MySQL or Oracle isn't that much difference. There is some purchasing that you can optimize, but from a software architecture, it doesn't make that much of a difference. It's just really thinking through how do you want to operate that stuff, because I think you're still going to lose against the business people when it comes to solution choices. Service changes, again, Microsoft and every cloud vendor is still learning how that works. So Scott, again, my boss, is very happy that every 3 weeks he announces new things in Azure. He has this blog that I assume all of you read. So everybody who wants roadmap information about Microsoft should just read Scott's blog every 3 weeks. If you can keep up with all that stuff, that's pretty cool, because it's actually very detailed what he writes out there. But we have a problem. Because we change every 3 weeks, there's a certain set that we will change on you. And IT, classic, has done two things. We make choices, we invest in them, we deploy it, and then we don't touch it forever, if we could. If we didn't have to do patching, if we didn't do any of this stuff, that would be perfect. And it would ideally run forever. Unchanged, just keep going. Part of the question that we need to think about is, with these new changes coming around, we will create software differences that are even bigger than what you're used to. The on-premise releases are going to go to at least a yearly cycle. So when you are on Windows 2008, let's say, I don't know when we released that thing, but let's assume that's already three releases. The next one is coming in April 2015. Then the next one is coming in April 2016, and you still have 2008 in your data centers. How are you going to keep up with these things? And so we are doing some technology investments, but part of the question is how do we work with you to help you understand how you can make the innovation changes, the change management changes, in order to really drive the change. And educate the people in the business that change is a good thing. Because they are the ones often, not always, but often, that say, I don't want to change. This is all good for me. It works. My users don't want change. The big thing that we have learned from the XP update is that the XP update to a modern world, if it's our world or another world, is so big that you actually have to retrain your workforce. They cannot make the leap, especially if they are not 20, from what XP looks like to what either an Android world looks like or a modern Windows world looks like. It just doesn't compute. And that's really part of the question is how do we help people to make small changes continuously so that they don't wake up someday and saying, oh shit, now I have this big difference. That's really what I would like us to talk about. And the other piece for us, and we again would welcome your feedback and work with you, is how do we introduce change into the cloud so that it doesn't interrupt your business too much? We had a couple of challenges lately with that. If you have been affected, apologize. We are working through what can we do better to drive the changes in the infrastructure and in your software without impacting you too much. But again, you will have to start thinking about on your premises. This is not something that you can avoid. Change is the constant now, and we have to figure out how to deal with this. Deployments, if you are thinking cloud, hybrid or otherwise, and you don't have an identity strategy, don't think cloud, hybrid or otherwise, because it doesn't work. Identity is the cornerstone of clouds. If there's one big thing that I would look at, Microsoft used to call themselves the desktop company. Actually, in the enterprise, we really are the identity company, because Active Directory runs identity for most enterprises out there. And Azure Active Directory is working towards the same play in terms of how we want to help you with managing the identity, which is actually one of the most important pieces, because it actually represents your users or, in the future, your devices. If you are into the Internet of Things, you know that you need to think about how do I identify those devices, how do I manage them, and all this other good stuff without necessarily a user being there. So having an identity strategy is, for me, number one investment when you think about cloud. Private as well, because, again, you're trying to figure out how do you authenticate users, charge them, and so forth. Privacy and security, again, another piece where the cloud people are investing a heck of a lot of money into compliance. I don't want to rattle off all the stuff that we do, but FedRAMP, FISMA, HIPAA, PCI, all that stuff, if you know all of these acronyms, then you know how expensive they are. And so part of this thing is we are seeing that a lot of people are driving compliance into legal frameworks that affect you. Your private cloud will have to come up not necessarily with all of these standards, but if you handle credit card data, you better are PCI compliant. Even if you don't think that you are falling under the PCI thing, there are certain data elements that will effectively drive you. So if you think compliance is something for the other people, think again, because it is something that will affect you. If I were you and you are collecting payment information, don't collect the credit card. There are services out there that tokenize those things, and don't store them on premise. Because whatever you think, you already hacked. Just go from there, and then you will find that there are certain defensive measures that you need to take based upon that assumption. Again, our cybersecurity guys can tell you lots of good stories what's going on. So I won't talk much about this because we talked about this already a lot, but this one here is important. I know that a lot of you talk about SLAs very frequently, but I've talked to lots of internal IT teams and they really don't have an SLA, a real SLA established that they will create as a contract between themselves as an IT organization and the business application that they host. If you would do that, a lot of things would change. If I'm a business guy and I say, hey, I'm going to host this fancy new app, what do I want to do? I want to ask for the maximum amount of availability, for example, if I even understood what that meant. 5 nines, sounds good to me. That means something very painful for you is clearly not of their concern because you didn't establish the contract. Because the contract has two things with it. One, it actually puts you not in control necessary, but at least it establishes a control framework. Meaning you tell them what you are willing to do, and you also tell them what it's going to cost them. Because every time I've had this conversation with some business people, and I changed it and saying, okay, I'm going to give you 5 nines for, let's say, $10,000 a unit, or I give you three nines for $1,000 a unit, guess where we ended up? 3 nines. It was all of a sudden perfectly fine. And so use SLAs not just as a contractual thing, but as a negotiation tool with those business guys. And if you ever, all of you read the SLAs on Windows Azure or Microsoft Azure, you know that they are not just talking about availability, right? So for example, if you use the storage accounts, they actually will put a threshold on you as well. going to saying, okay, you can only do 2,500 reads per second per storage accounts because otherwise we will throttle you and stuff like that. So there's lots of ways you can play around with this SLA, and making it explicit allows the business people to say, okay, fine, here's something I can negotiate. Go back to this upper thing. How many of you are really people, not technology people? I know it's a tough question, I know. One of the things that I always keep reminding my field people, used to be my consultants, now it's my field people, is that it's all about people. If you think this technology stuff is only about technology, you're already lost. Let me give you the story full. My friends, customers, they go into this private cloud business. We are going to do private clouds, and we are going to do IIS first. Okay, good, makes sense, technical strategy, good. And we will give people the ability to create VMs themselves, self-service, all that's all cool. The second sentence is, okay, and we are going to put SharePoint Exchange and LinkUp as a service as well, or SQL, or whatever the heck it is. And I said, okay, you sure? Yeah, that will come later at some point. So what's your strategy to make people adopt that SharePoint thing that you're going to put out? What do you mean? Well, if people have a VM, they will actually, you pry that VM out of their dead hands. Why? Because they love control. They love to be able to be in control of that VM that's theirs. They can do whatever they want with it. They don't have to deal with you pesky people asking all sorts of questions, dumb or otherwise, it doesn't really matter, because they love control. And if I can put a SharePoint into my VM and not ask you for permission, I'm done, I'm great. And so when you think about all of these things, always think about the human element. What would you do if somebody would take away your infrastructure toys? It's called public cloud. What do? You push private cloud and VPNs and IIS. Because again, that's you in control. So think about yourself, and then when you negotiate with those business people, always think they are people. Give them something that they can control, and it's a much better conversation. SLAs are a control framework, as much as this is establishing explicitly what you're signing up for. But give them something to negotiate with, and so you have a much better conversation with those guys. I love builds. I always get confused by these build slides. How many clicks do I have to do on this thing? I admire people that can do this. So define the fabric. If I get my thingy to move. Here we go. Mostly yesterday's platform. How many of you are 60% virtualized, 80% virtualized? That's pretty good. Most customers I meet are still very, very challenged with virtualization, despite it not being a new concept in any case. How many people think that VMware invented virtualization? Trick question. Our mainframe guys did this a long time ago in the 60s. Most of you, some of you were born, some of you weren't. So think about the application stack that we normally have. We have an operating system. We have a various set of functions. We call them roles. Then you have applications, and you effectively provide context either through configuration or you run the app. Used to be the case we do this, and we run setup.exe everywhere, right? So that's the usual life. And this is effectively what you do. You purchase, you install, deploy, configure, and you do this for every application, for every server. And we give you System Center to make that easier, which is a fair deal, but it doesn't really help you that much. Then we effectively introduced virtualization all up, which effectively helps you to break the coupling between the hardware and the software that runs on top. However, the software in itself is still statically bound. You still do the purchasing, install, deploy, configure per server. And what we are really looking to do is this fabric-based thing that we talked about before, where you're effectively trying to break not only the link between the hardware and the software that runs, you're also trying to break the allocation of that software in a static fashion. Meaning, if I go today into most customers, despite virtualization, they still allocate a very specific set of resources, fixed, fairly static, to their applications. And for some applications, that makes a lot of sense. You don't want to screw around with your SAP system or whatever ERP system you use. Or if you have day-end processing, you don't want to do that. But other things should be moving much more flexible. And part of what we're looking at is, can we effectively drive this change into this fabric-based mode where the fabric is effectively available as a set of resources and you allocate them based upon need, ideally dynamically. Now I'm seeing all these real-time dynamic people go up again and saying, I need to change every 2 seconds. That's not the case. What you're really doing is you're looking at demand patterns, and ideally you anticipate the demand pattern. If you're looking at banking customers, trading customers, payments, that kind of thing, the time when they're really, really busy is actually from 3:30 p.m. EST to 4 p.m. EST, maybe 4:01. Because everybody is trying to wait to the last second before they actually start to make their payments, their trades, whatever the heck it is, in order to close, use the closing time. So it would be really cool if you could take the fabric that you have and allocate it for the last 30 minutes to the entire thing. So Exchange could actually go down, or SharePoint, or other things that you don't need for this stuff, and you effectively drive it from there. And that's really what we are trying to drive towards with fabric-based computing. So if you think about fabric, think about this as serves multiple workloads or roles. Today, we can do this on the infrastructure layer. We can do this if you're investing in PaaS, platform as a service, where we have more control. Once you use VMs, we are out of the business. You are not, because you understand what those VMs do. So there are things you can do in that VM layer that you have to do from the outside, because we don't understand what those patterns are, because we can't look into the VM. And we gave you a contract, or you gave a contract to your business apps. So you need to start thinking about, how do I get people to understand that I will take stuff away, might even break the SLA I gave them, but only for a short period of time. And that's really part of what we're looking at. And we're looking at other ways to create a PaaS fabric where your application logic is effectively completely dynamic. So if you use Windows Azure Web, I don't want to call it websites because it's such a diminishing term. It's called web solutions, really, because they do sites, yes, but they also have API management in there. They have REST-based API computing and so forth. So it's a much more of a web solution layer, and that is fairly dynamic. That is completely transparent and acts as a fabric. Nobody knows how many servers are actually serving your web solution. You don't know. We won't tell you. We will just serve based upon the design, the necessary resources. But that requires you to rewrite your app. And again, we are not there in a lot of cases, but that's something that we certainly look at. From a technology perspective, we are looking at fabrics. Again, most of you will have known about Windows Server, the software-defined data center layers that we provide in the software stack, in the networking stack, and of course in the compute stack. Most of you will have heard about FastTrack by now, which is effectively a guidance that's coupling OEM design patterns with our software design patterns so that you can optimize those. FastTrack 4 should be out, which is specifically focused on JBOTs. So if you are interested in software-defined storage, attaching JBODs to a Windows Server design, FastTrack 4 ought to be out to help you with those learnings, because it's not quite as simple as it says in the brochures. There's a lot of things you need to think about, especially with the controllers. So that's something to think about. And then the other fabric is Microsoft Azure, where we effectively provide you with three layers of services. Infrastructure services, data services, and application services. And of course, all of those you can mix and match in Azure as well as across the pond. You have seen the hybrid cloud connectivity layer that we just announced. Don't expect any magic, though. The thing that I'm talking with that team about is, don't tell me that you can just take a website that runs SQL Server and ASP.NET on-premise. You take the ASP.NET layer and put it on Azure Web Solutions or services, and it works. Don't do that to me, because I will get the escalations when it doesn't work, because the latency doesn't go away. If you don't have caching layers in there and you don't understand latency, don't do this hybrid cloud connectivity thing. It is very nice technology. It's awesome. But it doesn't do magic. Like, oh yeah, latency does not matter. Actually, when I think about cloud computing, I would always add identities first. Second one is latency. Understand the network is there. Don't do a DCOM thing to me. Remember those DCOM days? Some of you are like, DCOM? Where the RPC paradigm and the monikers, where we say, yeah, we will marshal this transparently for you. If you do this in a local area network, that's fine. That's cool. Works. But remember those Outlook days when Outlook was an RPC client? It still is, but we did some tricks where you had this little, now at that time it was a sand clock turning around, not just a little wheel. But effectively, you could wait for hours before Outlook connected over a 28.8 modem. Even over a faster connectivity, it didn't work. So latency is important. So think about the fabric as these elements of things that you can use to drive infrastructure today. And start to look into PaaS. Again, the Windows Azure web solutions are also available on-premise using the Azure Pack as the delivery vehicle. So if you really wanted to look into PaaS, you could start there, and it's a really nice way of thinking about it. Now let's talk about services. And again, we're switching tack a little bit. So if you are a software designer, now it's your turn. But I will keep it relevant for the infrastructure people as well. Because I know that a lot of people are there. This friendly little fellow, Mr. Lucas, celebrated his 70th birthday yesterday, so congratulations to him. I like him because he does teach us something. You must unlearn what you have learned. The number one thing, so most of you saw my face on Monday morning in this video thing, right, that Brad showed, if it doesn't recognize. Hi. I'm the dreamer guy that said, you guys need to start dreaming in order to really change the world. And I mean that seriously. It sounds like a corny little thing, but actually it is serious. I've seen organizations that are solving current problems, which is clearly what we need to do. They will go on a trajectory that's fairly linear, but there I've seen people that really start to say, let's keep that for now out of my view and really think about what we want to achieve, and they go post-linear. And that's really something that we have to think about when we look at little Yoda to say, you know too much already. Start with something where you don't forget everything, but at least try and assume that the world has changed. So good old Yoda is something that I look at very clearly. A while back, we wrote some guidance that's out there on the web since a while called Failsafe Services. The reason why I'm using this is because these six actually do help you with thinking about cloud computing and also your transformation from a line of business silo developer into how do I deploy fabric-based elastic computing. Everybody blathers about elasticity, right? Elasticity is one of those where if you can avoid it, do it. It's a very naughty thing because it's very hard to do. We have now technology in place that does data center defragmentation. What? Well, what do you think about? When we do elasticity, what we do is we cheat. We make a bet that your load patterns are different across a number of deployments, and we can stuff more software into the hardware we have. This infinite cloud resources elasticity stuff is a fake, guys. There is no magic. We have lots of servers, but we also have lots of customers. And so this SLA thing actually does have a boundary in place so that we can play. And we make a bet that we can play faster than your demand ramps up or down. That's effectively what the fabric controller in Azure does. That's why Mark is hired by Microsoft to worry about that problem, because that's a very complicated business. So when we now have, let's say, two solutions running in the same fail-fault domains, guess what happens? We run out of space. Now I need to take your solution, service A, and move it around because I don't have room to grow. There's only so many atoms, even in virtual machines and overdrafting and whatnot. At some point in time, you will use the resource that's out there. So what we do is defragmentation. And that's some of the things that we have to start looking at. And part of this is how do you help us or your own elasticity models that you want to run on-premise to get there. So these things are effectively elements that help you with that and help you structure the conversation with the software designers or your partners that design software for you to effectively move forward. So first lesson learned, nothing new, but again, worth pointing out, the world is moving into scale-out computing, not scale-up computing. It's a little bit funny because on Monday we announced much bigger VMs and lots of capability that I would say 2 years ago we would have not considered cloud relevant. But for big compute, we are now introducing InfiniBand, RDMA, blah, 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 all that stuff you saw. So there is a certain crossover that actually makes machines much bigger. But in general, we assume scale out, not scale up. So if you are a scale-up person, because you come from a mainframe background or from a supercomputer background, thinking through what distribution means and distributed software, because it does introduce changes, is something you need to think about. While we will introduce more capability, the failure models, the reliability models, and everything else is based upon scale-out, not scale-up. That's something to keep in mind when you design for that stuff. The other piece I mentioned before already, think about failures. All of you have heard about Netflix Chaos Monkey by now, right? If you haven't, just Bing or Google it. It will tell you that Netflix, at least they claim, are actually running failures into their production system. They're flicking switches and having a monkey around in their data center. How many of you will do this to their production system? Okay. You should start thinking about this. And don't do it necessarily start in production. Maybe you want to do this in pre-production or test or something like that. But eventually, you should be confident enough that the measures you take in software are able to sustain failure. Because the failure will happen. The other piece that it does, and I'll tell you a story from our own people. So the SharePoint guys are my favorites, whipping boys and girls on that one. Very, very nice people, love all of them. But they have a mindset that's very functional oriented. So they write great features. But before they had to operate their own software, they didn't really think about operations that much. Yes, there was some support for operations in there. But mindsets change if you get a pager. How many of you have to carry a pager? I don't, so I'm very happy on that one. But it changes when it's Saturday morning, 3 a.m., and all of a sudden this page goes off, and you're saying, customer A is down because of your code. Please come in and debug and fix at 3 a.m. in the morning. All of a sudden, things will change because people will drive defensive code practices into their code and not be quite as aggressive as they might have been before. And so when you look at SharePoint from 2007 to 2013, from a software perspective, you will notice the difference. There's a much bigger emphasis on deployment, updates, and that kind of thing, because guess what? They have to do the deployment and updates now. And you will see that continue because we are running public clouds at scale. And so our software, which is the same code base pretty much, is going into your data centers the same way as they go into our data centers. So that's a good thing. So some of this you might have seen, always be failing. Always assume something breaks. Don't assume everything is hunky-dory. Bill Gates used to do this to lots of people. I'm sure you have heard some of his product reviews. He used to be fairly excitable, let's call it that. When you're getting called, this is the worst thing I've ever seen, you are an idiot, and you know that he's kind of excited. I was personally abused once by him like that, but that's, I guess, a badge of honor by now, saying, yes, Bill abused me. But part of his feedback was always, hey, you show me the happy path. What happens if this stuff doesn't work? What happens if this thing breaks? Or what you're projecting doesn't happen? What are we going to do then? What's your strategy? And so some of you might seen this movie, which is Always Be Selling. But again, at the end of the day, it's Always Be Failing. Something breaks, what are you going to do? What's your strategy? The other piece that you always think about, how many of you think about decomposition and composition and service orientation and all this other good stuff? Huh? All of you do, right? Everybody's happy. Yeah, reuse. Awesome. If you could build a monolithic piece of code and get away with it, Do it. Why? Taking dependency is a really hard business. Because those other people could fail. If you have a piece of code that runs on raw iron, actually, it's the most stable piece of software you will ever find. And there is lots of magic in here in terms of, okay, when you calculate the nines, there's lots of magic between, okay, I take a dependency on, that's SendGrid, good one. So we see a lot of customers use SendGrid because it's a very cute little software piece. They have no SLA. All of you are familiar with null as the relational term of unknown. Once you have a service in there that has no SLA, you have to put your own SLA up as null. Because you have no idea what the availability is, except if you know how to deal with that and say, okay, if SendGrid isn't available, that's okay, because I know how to deal with it and queue requests to the SendGrid thing or whatever the technologies might be. But if you do assume that that thing is always there, you should put null on your SLA because you have none. How many of you remember the Facebook identity failure? They had an outage last year where all of a sudden people couldn't log into their apps anymore because Facebook was gone. And when you read the details, actually Facebook has no SLA on the identity stuff. It's a service for the good of mankind. But that's what it is. So SOA, don't get me wrong, is the right architecture pattern. We want to drive reuse and so forth, but you also have to know that when you do that, you have to understand what it means to your network, to your infrastructure, and so forth, security boundaries, management boundaries, and so forth. But you also have to take understanding that you're taking dependencies on things that might fail. What if you, we did this actually to you guys. So when the IIS update happened last early April, two things ran in parallel. We actually had a hardware update, top of rack switch updates and so forth, and we introduced the new plans for basic, standard, and premium on IIS, and those collided because the teams, although they had talked with each other, didn't really detail each other. So they didn't share, okay, I'm running the update here, and they were running effectively this way, and for some customers, they hit. And so they were hit twice or three times with lots of reboots and stuff like that. So if you think about service operations, we manage that, right? You will say, well, you are in charge of a service. Great. You are dependent on him. He does an update. How would you know? So those are some of the things when I talk about the anatomy of a service. You always need to understand what is it that you're depending on, what is the SLA, and if you are Pottermore. Pottermore said, yeah, we're going to rely on Facebook. Good. Then they said, in terms of identity. And so they said, we asked them, so did you talk to Facebook? No, why? They're a cloud service. They're scaling infinitely. Yes, they're pretty good. But if you come with 60 million identity requests, you might want to talk to these people because they might want to pre-design capacity to do this. So if you do something very big on Azure, let me know, so that I can tell our people that they actually take care that this capacity is actually there. Because if you say, oh, I need 500,000 cores, we can do it, as we have shown, but it does take a while. So always understand what you are thinking about. The other piece to think about is a scale unit. So most people think about elasticity in one VM at a time. That's the worst thing you can do. Internally or externally, it doesn't really matter. Because there are more dependencies than just the VM. If you scale, let's say, your site, but let's take keep on Facebook, but the Facebook identity guys cannot keep up, sorry, you're dead. So you need to think about how do you scale up the systems you need in order to drive. So that's the scale up question. And then the scale down, the same thing. How do you take resources away but do so in equal measure so that the other system that depends on a certain resource actually scales down with you. So if you have DNS requests or other things, you need to make sure that the DNS servers can handle either the increased load or okay with decreasing as well. So those are some of the things that you need to think in when you say scale unit. Don't think just a VM at a time. First, it's very inefficient for both sides, and you really want to think about, hey, how do I drive capacity? How many of you do capacity planning? Good, you're honest. How do you do this? Experience and, right? Effectively, and then you don't trust anybody and at 25%, something like that. Whatever the factor is you feel confident with, which means you do over-provisioning. That's what happens. I've seen it a number of times with customers where they say, hey, we are 150,000 user organization, everybody going to have a SharePoint team site, project site, my site. And you look around and after 2 years into the project, they have scaled up this huge farm, lots of servers, the OEMs are happy, the storage guys are happy, but the storage units is at 2% utilization, there's 15,000 users active, not the 150,000. So scale units also allow you to grow gradually and effectively keep pace with the deployments. So guidance that we ship by now for SharePoint, Link, and so forth is actually scale unit based because we drive a capacity management approach rather than a capacity planning approach. And the capacity management approach is based upon how many things, users, mailboxes, requests, transactions, can I put into a given unit of resources? So instead of thinking about the entire thing, you're thinking about a slice of the thing. You're saying, okay, I can serve 5,000 users with this usage profile out of these three VMs or five VMs and so forth. That's what a scale unit is at the end of the day. But including the dependent systems that we need to understand. Pet peeve. And again, you guys are all IT people, so you should become happy. But most of the time when I get called in or my brethren and sisters get called in into a disaster call, something happened, we're looking at it saying, okay, how are we supposed to debug this thing? You have no instrumentation, no logging, no nothing. And so we look into this fog called the system, which means... And don't get me wrong, there's lots of brand names out there that went out there and did interesting projects, but they have no idea how to run a service with the right instrumentation. And then you say, okay, cool, I can effectively use perf counters and stuff like that to understand the health of my system. Yeah, a bit. But have you ever tried to make out business logic reading TCP package? That's effectively the same idea. You can understand what the performance impact is and resource usage, clearly, but you don't understand what's happening inside the app. The app has to become instrumented, period. And there's lots of ways to do that. Visual Studio has just released App Insights. We have a partnership with New Relic. So there are a bunch of vendors out there that help you with the apps. But if you don't instrument anything, don't put anything on my cloud, please. Because I don't want to talk to you when you have this disaster thing, and then I have to tell you, sorry, I can't help you because I have no data to help you with. We can still do stuff, obviously, but it's much easier if we have some data to work with. Whoops. So effectively, what we're trying to figure out here is how do you put information into the system? And here I'm going to break a piece for my cloud, for my patterns and practice people. They have just released 25 cloud patterns that are based upon 3-4 years of learning from large projects in terms of what is it that you really want to collect. I'll share the link to the website later in the deck. So health endpoint monitoring pattern. So this is effectively something that we have we're pushing to people to say, hey, monitor the endpoints at the very least. So that the endpoint is healthy and so forth. You know about synthetic transactions. You know about all of that stuff. Are you using them aggressively in your private cloud or service-oriented approach? It doesn't really matter if it's private or public and so forth. The other piece that we talked about a lot is resilience modeling and analysis. That is currently an internal Microsoft asset, but we are working on releasing it so that you can use the same patterns that we use internally to do risk analysis in terms of service orientation, what might go wrong. Most of you will have remember this thing, little Death Star, remember that thing? And you remember also that Mr. Luke, through the power of the Force, disturbed it quite badly, actually found this little thing and this happened. I'm sure the Death Star designers thought they had all things covered. But they didn't, because they didn't have the risk analysis models that we have, right? And so part of this is that led to pretty big disaster there. I won't go through all of these things, but part of this is how do you discover, document, discover, rate, and act? Not every failure point you might find is actually a risk to your system. And so it's a very useful exercise because you will start to go through your infrastructure design. Is it really as resilient as I want it to be? Always remember this wanting to be is very important. It's easy to build a system that's very, very available. Tandem Computer did this forever, so-called the non-stop systems, but it's really, really expensive. So the question is, do you need that kind of availability or resiliency in order to be efficient with your services? Or is a different resilience point okay? The number one thing that we find is that people look at external dependencies with too much trust. And external dependencies could be another service, but could also be a thing like a configuration file. You assume that the configuration file is at a certain place, and it actually is valid. What if it isn't? What if it isn't there, or what if the stuff that's in there is nonsense? And so part of this thing is, okay, how do you deal with this? So first of all, understand what the failure point is, but then the second point is, what do you do with that? I love my friends from Netflix because they do a bunch of public services, meaning they document how they deal with it. And so all of you have heard about Microsoft Azure Traffic Manager, right? That's a failure point, by the way, because that thing could go down, and then what? So a low-tech solution to the traffic management problem is, hey, I got IP addresses at some point. Why don't I stuff them into a file? So the next time, maybe when the traffic manager fails, I at least have some IP addresses I can directly go up. Very simple stuff, but how many of you put that into your client code? No, there's magic. I have a traffic manager thing, and it will take care of me. Well, if it doesn't, what do you do then, right? So think about these kind of ideas of how do you document what's going on, and this is a graphic of how we do this today. We are working with the Visual Studio team of how we productize this guidance into Visual Studio so that when you do threat modeling, which is one type of modeling, you can also do resilience modeling or failure modeling, which is really this different side of the same coin, because a threat generally is also often a failure that could be introduced into the system. Of course, we have to have a cute little acronym. The C is silent, so think about DIAL. As the acronym, because the original idea was discover what's going on, what is incorrect, think about authentication as a big one, limits, because you're running into throttling or into limits that you introduced, and all of a sudden things go bad, or you're looking at latency, so the SQL example that I gave you before, and then the component piece is effectively some configuration changes, code changes, something that happened. And then what are the effects? What is the portion affected of your service? How do you detect it? How long does it take to resolve these things? And what's the likelihood of happening, this stuff? And we have used this for SharePoint Online, a bunch of e-commerce sites that we are running in the background on Azure. And we are starting to work with the Azure core team on the same modeling. So they go through the same kind of thing that you would go through. And this is an Excel sheet that effectively walks you through this resiliency modeling and analysis in terms of, okay, what are the components, what's the failure short name, failure description, and then you effectively have an impact thing, which is effect, portion affected, detection, resolution, and then you assign a likelihood on it. And then you prioritize. One of the things I love about Steve Sinofsky, who is not with Microsoft anymore, but still I think some of the stuff that he did is very cool. One of the things he always does is give me data, and then let's prioritize the top X. Is it top 5, top 10, and so forth. Before Sinofsky took over Windows, so we get a lot of these Watson errors, so the error log files that some people send back to us. So I think it's 1 million a day, or I have no idea. So lots of stuff. And we used to do this first come, first serve. So when we got a report in, somebody got assigned to it and fix it. if it was only applicable to that one PC, if it's really not that often, we didn't really care. The Windows before Sinofsky, the Windows post-Sinofsky does analysis on the data level and says, wait. First of all, show me the top 10 errors and show me how many people are affected by this thing. If it's really a lot of people, then let's fix that one. So the whole prioritization in terms of what are you wanting to fix, protect against, and so forth, comes back to you're in a software-oriented world now, and now you have choices, but you have to make them in order to really drive the necessary investments and so forth. This is effectively an outcome of what's going on. Couple of things that we really, if you write Azure-based code, please introduce retry patterns. I've seen a lot of code where customers didn't retry at all. The only retry pattern that's consistent is the database connectivity. Why? Because we have MSDN samples that show you how to do it. And seriously, I'm not joking. People cut and paste, which is a great thing. But if it's other things and there is no good sample, people won't do it. Although it's the same thing. It's like, why is this so hard? Opening up a configuration file, do a retry around it. Stuff like that. The other piece, and the CAT guys, the customer advisory team, have their own blog, is transitory failures. So you are trying, it fails. While you are waiting, the system actually comes back up. So you don't know that something actually has changed already. And so the bunch of transitory errors that you have to think about are very naughty, that could get you very complicated, and there are patterns in there that help you detecting transitory errors. So retry pattern. Please, if you write code, put retries in. Even automation code, because all of you IT people are now coders. You know that, right? PowerShell, what do you think that is? It's code, so I hope you have Visual Studio Online set up for those artifacts, right? Nope. So you might want to think about that, putting a code depot on Visual Studio so that you can version it and so forth. Just to give you a little fun there, it's actually normal people, when you read data center error reports, what happens, the operator is at fault. The human person at 3 a.m. bleary-eyed did something wrong. It's true. That is actually the number one cause. But automation can do so many things so much faster. Yes, that's also true. We had a script that somebody wrote for working with the Cisco routers. That thing was never really tested, and it effectively screwed it up. And the Cisco router was so fast in replicating the table that we lost all of our routing tables. Right? So if you think about automation, everything that the human can do very slowly and once, the automation can really do very, very fast. They're very good at that. So you really want to test that stuff. Because while I appreciate your PowerShell prowess, it is really something you have to version and so forth. It's a software asset that has to be treated like any other software asset. Circuit breaker pattern, that's a thing also that our friends from Netflix have popularized. It was there before, obviously. But that effectively says, we have seen this before, so people write code and they do retries, and instead of backing off, they actually increase the retry rate, saying, if I hit it harder, maybe it will actually do it. No, don't do that. That's one design effect. But the other one is, it's okay that you will see errors. You will see errors in distributed systems. That's the way it works. But you need to decide, what is my threshold until I actually cease to function? That's what the circuit breaker is for. And once the circuit breaker gets pushed, you then need to decide what you're going to do with it. So I mentioned the SendGrid example. And again, I'm not picking on SendGrid if somebody's a fan. I'm just using it as an example. You then need to decide that you don't want to send email anymore for a while until SendGrid comes back up. And so you effectively make decisions based upon the circuit breaker. You're seeing errors coming in, so something is wrong. And you design this threshold. Then you say, OK, I'm done. I need to deal with it. Throttling pattern, so what we do to you, meaning the SLA talks about availability, but also about actually here's what we really do for you, whatever, 2,500 IOPS per second per storage account or something like that. I don't know what the exact number is. So read the SLA before you make decisions. Do it to your customers. Meaning throttling is a very good way of protecting your resources. And good news is that most of the web servers and other technologies that you might depend on already introduce throttling capabilities into the infrastructure. So you can actually dial it up and down and saying, okay, if this low-paying customer comes in, we give him basic service. If this high-paying customer comes in, we give him premium service. That's how that works, and you can use it to effectively drive your decision. So this is the pattern poster that is out there. I love these blue things. They are A3 size, so you can't read any of it. So here is the web page that you can look at. And the copies of the posters were supposed to be here, but for some reason they couldn't distribute them, so you have to go to the SCT booth, whatever that is. It's down there somewhere. SCT is what it's called, and that's where you can get physical copies of the poster. You can also reprint it from the website, or you can just take a look at the pattern. There are 25 of them. I only talked about four because this was not about all the patterns, but they are really, really patterns that we have learned with lots of pain and grief with a lot of customers across the globe. So those are patterns that actually work. Thank you, Tom, for putting that in. That there's lots of information out there, lots of resources. You know these slides already. Blah, blah, blah. Complete an evaluation, and you might still get the Xbox with a Kinect. We just unbundled it, I heard. And so if you do it, you might get one with the Kinect sensor, which is actually awesome. And then please evaluate the session. Give us feedback, or me feedback in this case. And just in summary, the thing that happens with these big patterns and the architecture shifts is that slowly they will come to you. So while the enterprise IT is slower, quote unquote, not slow, in adopting some of these things, you now see software-defined data centers is the rage. VMware is talking about it. Windows Server is shipping it. And talking about it as well. So that whole stuff, we have been running software-defined stuff in the cloud for 4 years, 5 years, 6 years. Now it's becoming IT stuff. And you will see the software side of the patterns that I talked about roll down your way as well. There are a couple of other things that are happening around in-memory computing that you will have to deal with sometime soon if you're not dealing with it already, but that's for another day. With that, I wish you an awesome time out there, and thank you for your patience and interest, and thanks for supporting TechEd. Thank you.